Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. Welcome. I have Ken Carloni here with us today. Thank you for joining us as the guest speaker for this episode. Would you like to introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what you do?
I am, as Jessica said, Ken Carloni, and I'm currently the vice president at Umpqua Watersheds, and I'm a founding member from back in the mid-90s. And I also taught biology and natural resources at Umpqua Community College for 31 years until I retired in 2018. And since then, I've continued my work with Umpqua Watersheds, but I'm also working with another nonprofit, the Ewe Creek Land Alliance, and we're working on habitat restoration and biochar production there, as Jessica knows, because she was out with us doing a burn back a year or so ago, right? And
yeah.
So my focus now is on habitat restoration, biochar production, and doing consulting along those lines. I originally started out my career at the University of Connecticut and did a bachelor's and a master's there in evolutionary ecology. I actually studied pollination biology, but when I arrived in Oregon and realized that forests and forest issues were a huge deal here, I got a PhD at Oregon State University in forest ecology there. And my focus in my research there was on the use of fire by Native Americans in this area to manage the forest in ways that Europeans didn't really understand until fairly recently. And now we're seeing more and more of Native American traditional ecological knowledge being used in the forest to repattern the forest back to a more historic condition.
Wonderful. Thank you. Let's talk about the Rock Creek Fish Hatchery. Back in 2020, it was burnt by the Archie Creek fire. And I think it would be great to provide a little bit of information. So would you like to talk about that, Ken?
Sure. The hatchery was originally developed in the 1920s, as many hatcheries of the era were a century or more ago. And what happened, of course, was that logging, intensive agriculture, and pretty harsh practices of the day degraded habitats to the point where fish returns were dropping, getting lower and lower. And of course, Salmonids 101 here, we're in a situation here, as most of you know, where we have many runs of salmonid fish, salmon and steelhead, that spend the early part of their life in upland streams here in fresh water. And then as juveniles, we call them smolts at that point, a couple, 3-4 inches long, will migrate out to the ocean, spend 2 or 3 years in the ocean, getting, eating a lot, getting fat and huge. And then they return to their natal streams, the streams where they were born, to spawn, and then they die, and the new generation follows that same pattern back to the ocean and back. So as these sort of harsh early 20th century practices took their toll on fish numbers, in a way that was very much in the thinking of the day, technology was what was going to fix the problem, not going back and fixing the habitat, not doing habitat restoration. Just build a hatchery and make more fish. And the idea was that if you just replace the wild fish with hatchery fish, the runs will come back just as strong and everything will be great. There'll be fish for ocean trawlers to catch. There'll be fish for sports people to catch in the streams and so on. And so the Rock Creek Hatchery was patterned in that way. and functioned up until the 2020 Labor Day fires, this one in particular, the Archie Creek fire up the North Umpqua, that burned that hatchery to the ground, except for one building that survived there. It was called the Rock Ed building. It was more modern construction, metal roof, and it survived the fire. It was built for educational purposes, and I truly hope that what happens with that hatchery is that it doesn't get rebuilt as a hatchery, but it gets rebuilt as an educational facility. And as we get more into our discussion, we'll talk about, you know, why I think it's important for that hatchery not to be rebuilt.
Wonderful. Thank you. So continuing with the hatcheries, what are some of the benefits of hatchery fish and having a hatchery versus, you know, wild native fish?
Well, as I mentioned before, the hatchery was really, you know, a technological fix to an ecological problem. And so as far as benefit, quote unquote, of the hatchery, really in this modern era, except to the extent that wild runs need to be maintained until their habitats are restored, there is very little benefit to hatcheries for having a hatchery. And as we continue this conversation, we'll talk about what happens in a hatchery, what happens to the genetics or epigenetics of those fish in the hatchery, and how competition between hatchery fish and wild fish really decreases the fitness of the wild runs and ultimately causes more genetic loss to the wild runs than it improves the runs of overall fish. So as we'll see as we continue on later on, that more hatchery fish don't necessarily add up to more total fish returning. So the second part of that question, can we create the same benefits without the fish hatchery? The answer is unequivocally yes. Yes, we can. And that will require us to fix the damage that the last century has done to the spawning grounds of these fish. And once those are restored, even in the face of a change in climate, the wild fish, we believe, have a greater depth of genetics that will allow them to be able to tolerate these changes and adapt to these changes better than if they are mixed with hatchery-generated genetics to compete with.
So I kind of have a question. As the water in the rivers warm up, it impacts the wild salmon. Does this have the same impact on hatchery salmon? Are they born at the same temperature?
It does. And so river conditions are, at least in the, you know, in the North Umpqua and in most systems here, those impose an upper limit on the amount of fish that can, you know, survive to outmigrate. Ocean conditions then place an upper limit on the amount of fish that can survive in the ocean. And then river conditions, again, while the fish are in-migrating and back up to their spawning habitats, all affect the fish, and they generally affect the two runs of fish, the wild runs and the hatchery runs, equally. There are a few things that happen in the hatchery when fish are raised in concrete tanks and fed trout chow. They develop genetic conditions that are different from the wild fish. And one would think, and it's to their benefit, really, because what happens is that they sustain a lot of injury because they're all raised in one place and concrete tanks are not super friendly to their bodies. And so they get a lot of injuries, and the genetics to accelerate healing of injuries actually increases. And so they are actually more able to withstand the battering of the river than the wild fish are. But on the other hand, there are other epigenetics that cause them to behave differently, to be less aware of predators and they don't avoid predators as well, and a range of other things that happen because of the epigenetics that happened to them, in the epigenetic changes that happened because of them being raised in those hatcheries, that decrease their fitness relative to the wild fish. So that's really what, you know, what one of the big issues here is that those, you know, they are initially the brood stock, the eggs and the milk that are taken from the wild fish, are taken from wild fish and from hatchery fish and all mixed together in the hatchery. And so one might say, well, geez, you know, you're taking genetics from wild fish and you're mixing them in there. What's the big deal? Well, what will happen is that as those young fry, the young fish that are developing in those tanks grow, their responses to environmental challenges will change. Even though the actual imprints on their DNA are exactly the same, it's the on-off switches that happen to those genes that change with the conditions under which they're raised.
Which is very incredible.
Yeah. We thought, you know, it's only in the last few decades that we've understood this. By the end of the last century, we thought, okay, we've got genetics all figured out, you know, after Mendel and his peas and all that sort of stuff. We know how things work, and it's just mopping up from here. And that's when the big surprises came in, that changes that can happen to an individual can be carried on for at least two generations on into the future. We also discovered crazy stuff about which parent contributes a gene, whether it's the, you know, the male parent or the female parent, can determine how that gene is expressed in the offspring. So we've gotten a lot of surprises and a little bit of a comeuppance here in the last few decades. We thought we knew what was going on with genetics, and now we're realizing that it's a lot more complicated than we originally thought.
Yeah. Wild salmon and hatchery salmon, you said that they have similar runs, yet they fare differently.
That's correct. So what happens is that fish will return to Rock Creek if they're raised there, and that's easy to get the brood stock there because they swim right back to the hatchery. And so you wind up, able to use those fish for their eggs and their sperm to mix together and create the next generation. Many, the wild fish, of course, are spawning below and up in other tributaries, farther up the North Umpqua, up Steamboat Creek, and various other tributaries to the North Umpqua. And so they're swimming past Rock Creek. And not only that, but there's a value that fisheries biologists calculate. And it's got this very nerdy acronym, PHOS, we call it. It's the proportion of hatchery originating spawners. And so how do we know what's a hatchery fish and what's a wild fish? Well, it turns out that in order to be able to know that, the folks at the hatchery, when the smolts get up to a certain size, they'll clip the adipose fin. That's the tiny little fin right before their tail. And many studies have shown that that seems to be some sort of a vestigial structure or something. It does not change the fitness, the ability to survive and reproduce of those animals. And so hatchery fish are fin clipped. And so when you catch a 2 foot long salmon and it's missing that little bump right before its tail, you know that originated in the hatchery. And so when spawning surveys are done, the aquatic biologists will, you know, snorkel those areas and will look for the spawning fish to see whether they have an adipose fin or not. And so the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, knowing that the genetic mixing between hatchery spawners and wild spawners is to the detriment of the whole run, have determined that they don't want to see more than 10% PHOS. That is, they don't want to see more than 10% hatchery fish in the spawning areas with the wild fish. And it turns out that up Rock Creek, as you would imagine, that's 70%. Okay, that's way, way higher. But they're missing, they just miss the hatchery door and they just continue up Rock Creek. And that's completely understandable. But what they didn't expect was to see so much mixing downstream from the hatchery and upstream. There's still 30% PHAS, you know, the percentage of hatchery originating spawners spawning with wild fish in the reaches up above Rock Creek. So the fish are running at the same time. Basically, what will happen is that when the smolts are old enough and mature enough to migrate on their own, the hatchery managers will just open the door and let the fish sort of wander out as they will. And so over the course of, you know, several days or a week, these fish will slowly kind of trickle into the North Umpqua and start heading out toward the ocean. And but in the meantime, all of the smolts from upriver are passing by, and then all the smolts that are being produced downriver are heading out to the ocean. They are all competing for the same food and the same resources at the same time. And so not only are there, you know, epigenetic issues that we talked about before, there's just straight up competition between the two runs at getting food and avoiding predators. And typically the wild fish are better at getting food and avoiding predators, but there's such overwhelming amounts of smolts that are, you know, dumped into the river that the competition is fierce between the two genetic runs, let's call them. They're all one run in terms of their timing and pretty much their overall behavior of how they migrate and how they get out into the ocean and how they feed when they're out there and so on. But there's a tremendous amount of competition. And then another thing that oftentimes is overlooked is that raising tens of thousands of fish in confined areas dramatically exposes them to disease. And disease can just rip through a population of fish that are raised in that way. And they don't always catch the disease. They don't always, you know, the amount of disease is not, there's not a good way to really determine that. And so you just turn those fish loose and they may be harboring a number of pathogens that they can spread to the outmigrating wild fish that they run across, because there is such a huge concentration of fish being dumped out right at the mouth of Rock Creek or whatever, you know, creek the hatchery is on. That population density is much greater than it would be under natural conditions. And therefore, the ability to transmit disease from one fish to another is much greater just because of the density, because they're going to be bumping into each other a bunch more. They're going to be occupying the same water.
Why is it if a fish has a disease, it is still released into the river?
In many cases, it's not, because they don't even survive. And the problem with Rock Creek, really, and this is one of the reasons that I am not an advocate for rebuilding the Rock Creek hatchery in particular, is that something like 70% of the Rock Creek drainage has been logged, and clear cuts, or plantations rather, that are the result of clear cuts, pump a lot more water out of the soil and into the atmosphere than mature forests do. That's something that we've just now started to realize only in the last several years. And so the flows of Rock Creek had dropped. Because so much logging has cleared the buffers away from the streams, there's less shade on the streams, and so the water is warmer. So the water has more nutrients in it, which sounds like a good thing, but in an aquatic situation, you just want water in your water. You don't want all the other nutrients in there, because they're going to cause algal blooms, which are going to cause oxygen problems. And if they're toxic species of algae, they'll produce toxins and so on. Rock Creek water is very poor quality. And in order to keep that hatchery going, they actually had to install a pumping station on the North Umpqua River to pump water up Rock Creek to the hatchery, so that the water was good enough quality to actually raise those fish to maturity. If a pump breaks down, you know, which has happened over the last decade. There have been a number of situations where, you know, a power outage will happen. Some heavy rain will cause some problem, and, you know, and you'll lose 100,000 fish, you know, in a couple of days. So hatcheries are fraught with those sorts of issues. Water quality is huge. The poorer the water quality, the less fish are able to withstand the pathogens that are in there. And so in some cases, if the water conditions are held at you know, proper, you know, temperatures and turbidities and so on, those diseases, the fish can be carrying those diseases, but just not exhibit it because they're strong enough, they're well enough fed that they can overcome the debilitating aspects of those diseases and still wind up being released. I mean, that's a great question. Why would you release diseased fish into a river, right? There's really no way to examine every fish to know whether it's healthy or not. If it's swimming around, it's considered to be healthy enough to release out into the river.
You can't do a vet check on every single fish.
No, can't do that. Now, certainly they do, you know, they will add, you know, a certain amount of antibiotics and things like that. But viruses and other parasites are a large problem, and they're much more difficult to treat than simple bacterial diseases. Antibiotics work against bacteria, but they don't work against virus. And so there are a number of diseases that are just, you can't treat them. Once you've got them, you just do the best you can to control the conditions, give the fish the best chance they have to be able to outrun the diseases themselves. And then you open the gates.
That makes sense. So adding more hatchery fish to the population does not increase the overall population. And from what I understand, a lot of that is due to competition, you know, conditions of the water, what we've been discussing. So as far as, you know, the hatchery almost make more sense to, like you said, turn it into an education center and allow the wild salmon have a chance to get their population back up.
Right. And what happened when Rock Creek burned down is that they still collected fish that returned to the tank. The concrete tanks are still there. Okay. Yeah. The building burned down, but the tanks are there, and they were able to, you know, put new pumps in to be able to create what they call acclimation tanks there. So and then they raised those smolts, they raised the, you know, from eggs up to smolts, the small, you know, out-migrating sized fish, at a Rogue River hatchery. But if you take fish, you know, if you just, you know, pump all those fish into a big tanker truck, take them up to the North Umpqua and dump them in, they're not going to do well, because they need to be acclimated to the conditions of the North Umpqua. And so what they did was they brought those fish up from the Rogue, put them into the acclimation tanks at Rock Creek, pumped a bunch of, you know, North Umpqua water through there for a couple of weeks, and then released them. And so I could see I could imagine a situation where for some reason, a run of fish needed a boost of native genetics. So one could collect some native fish, and they do that at, wild fish, they do that at the Winchester Dam in the fish ladder there. So they'll collect the wild fish there. And then they send the eggs and the milt, the sperm from the males. In this case, they send it to Coal River Hatchery on the Rogue, and reared the fish there, brought them back to Rock Creek, acclimated them, and released them. That was last year. This year, they're proposing to collect fish at the hatchery. And I'm not 100% sure if they've made the decision all the way to do the same program again, because there is some legal stuff going on right now around that, using those tanks as simply as acclimation. So in an emergency, you could still use that Rock Creek facility for acclimation for smolts that were reared elsewhere.
I actually have a question. I know it was just last year that the decision was decided on this. Do you know what percentage of fish survived that were brought up from the Rogue and mixed in with the North Umpqua?
Yeah, there's no way to know that.
Okay. So is there an example of a hatchery program that was discontinued where the fish population flourished?
That's a great question, because people want to know, well, what's going to happen if we discontinue this program? What makes you so sure that wild fish are going to rebound on their own? And the answer is right up at Rock Creek. In the early 90s, up until the early 90s, winter steelhead were reared there and released. And their numbers were in, year after year after year, were declining and declining and declining until they got to, very low numbers. The hatchery program was discontinued, I believe it was in 1992. And then after 2 years, which is, of course, is what it takes for those smolts to outmigrate, spend 2 years in the ocean eating and building up their fat reserves and stuff so they can make the journey back into spawn. They began to come back in the mid 90s. And by, the early 2000s, their numbers were well over what they had been and continued to increase throughout the next two decades, to the point now where winter steelhead have very healthy runs now, and there's no hatchery program whatsoever on the North Umpqua for them, and there's a very robust run. Now, it's true they run at different times of the year, which is why they're called winter steelhead versus summer steelhead, but they're running in the same river and running out to the same ocean. And so if summer steelhead, if winter steelhead could rebound, we believe summer steelhead could too. We presented this information to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. That is the body that it's a seven-person commission that is appointed by the governor to oversee the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Department, ODF&W, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And their staff recommended that they continue the summer steelhead program at Rock Creek. We presented information backed up by hard science why that summer steelhead program should be discontinued. And the Fish and Wildlife Commission overruled their own staff, agreed with us, and determined that the summer steelhead program should be discontinued. Well, Douglas County and the Douglas Timber Operators Fish Derby and another fishing guide sued the state to reverse that decision. And so the smolts that had been raised in 2021, the eggs had been collected from fish from the North Umpqua, but because the hatchery burned down, they sent them down to a hatchery on the Rogue River to be reared there, brought back to the North Umpqua to be acclimated, that is, to be held in tanks of North Umpqua water for a while before they were released. We were against that because we felt like those fish would be better to be released in the Galesville Reservoir or any of the other reservoirs here in Douglas County, where they would grow into large non-ocean going trout and be available for anglers to catch. A lot more anglers would have caught those fish and being able to take them home and eat them than the fish that are now out in the ocean fending off killer whales and so on. So we would not have wasted those fish, and indeed more anglers would have been able to catch those fish. And the question also often comes up about, well, what about the commercial fisheries? What happens if you decrease the amount of fish out in the ocean? And the answer to that is that as far as the commercial fishery is concerned, it's really coho and chinook that are the big, that are the vast majority of what get caught out there. Steelhead are a very small percentage of what gets caught in the ocean. And not only that, but steelhead and one of the reasons that the North Umpqua is a famous, river among fly fishers around the world is that it is a steelhead river, and steelhead are high gradient fish, meaning that they live in far upstream in very steep gradient streams, these little tumbling great little creeks that we all love to hike up, they're just crashing down out of the mountains. That's where they spawn. They spawn the farthest up of any of the salmonid runs. And so they are the most difficult to catch. And so if you really want to test your mettle as a fly fisher from Chile or New Zealand or France, you come to the North Umpqua and you fish steelhead. But downriver, the steelhead that come by, that are coming by, there's very little steelhead caught downriver. The sport fishery is really here upriver. And fly fishers are very much, the fly fishing organizations are very much in support of what we're doing, because they understand that how important it is to have runs of wild fish. And they want to come here and fish a wild river with wild fish in them, the wiliest fish, the most difficult fish, the toughest fish to catch. That's what they want to come here and do. And so we believe that without the Rock Creek hatchery at all, the summer steelhead runs will recover. Winter steelhead runs have already recovered without any hatchery help. And the other runs of fish will also maintain their present numbers or increase. And the entire stretch of the North Umpqua will be a wild river, completely wild fish. And that will be even more of an economic draw for this area. So releasing fewer hatchery fish will allow the wild stocks to recover and therefore create a really premium fishing experience for super dedicated and oftentimes very well-off fishers that want to come and fish for some of the most difficult fish to catch and bring in.
And you are definitely right. Many people come from out of town, out of state to fish on the Umpqua.
And so, that was one of the, one of the criticisms is they thought, oh, if we don't have a hatchery program here, we won't have as many fish. People won't come here and fish and so on. Nothing could be further from the truth. At the worst, nothing will change. And at best, it will become even more world renowned for its wild runs of the most difficult fish to catch and bring to your net.
So if the fish population did start declining again, would a hatchery be beneficial to help the population come back?
As I say, I can imagine an emergency situation mm-hmm. where you had some kind of series of ecological catastrophes. I don't know what they might be, but something that pollutes the river, some volcanic eruption that, dumps a bunch of ash into the river and makes it acidic or something like that. I could see where a hatchery, we're collecting fish and raising them up and keeping those populations numbers up would be a good thing. But there is excess hatchery capacity all over the Northwest. And as a matter of fact, it was apparently no sweat for the Coal River Hatchery on the Rogue to raise our fish as well as their fish. So we have plenty of hatchery capacity without having to rebuild Rock Creek.
That is a very good point. Thank you. The steelhead travel up through the North Umpqua, which they have to get over the Winchester Dam, correct?
They do.
Okay.
As all the fish do.
Yes. So do you know if the Winchester Dam serves a purpose such as power or irrigation? Is there a reason for the dam?
The history of the dam is actually a little bit murky. It was built in the 1880s. Some people don't know exactly when. There's no picture of the river before that, but there was undoubtedly a narrows there, because at the Rod and Gun Club, about a mile downriver, there was a major Indian village there, a major village of the Umpqua people there. And typically, wherever there's a great fishing spot, a falls or a set of chutes, about a mile away, you'll find a major village. You won't find it right there because the grizzlies like that too. And so when grizzlies used to live in this area, they were major competitors with the people here. And so the people would kind of move out of the way when the grizzlies moved in, and then move back in when the grizzlies moved out. So we know that was a major fishing, well, we have strong evidence that was a major fishing spot. And so that's a perfect place to put a dam, right? Where the river narrows down and you can put a dam in. The original dam was fairly low and fish could actually jump it for the first part of the 1900s. It was probably either a sawmill or a grist mill or maybe both. But then the level was raised and it generated hydroelectricity for a time until it was discovered that the turbines were just chopping up smolts and sending them out in pieces on the other side. And so that was completely discontinued. There are only two reasons in Oregon that you can have a dam, and it's for power generation and irrigation. Recreation is not one of them. That's the only thing the only purpose that the Winchester Dam serves right now is recreation. It was originally built for power, right? For before there was electricity, of course, it was grist mill power or just general water wheel power. So, but since it's a historic dam, it's a legacy dam, if it stops being used for hydro or irrigation, there's no mandate to take it out. However, a fish ladder, once they raised the level of the dam and fish could no longer jump it, they put in a fish ladder. But the fish ladder is very poorly designed and the fish can't find the entrance very easily. So what they wind up doing is they wind up throwing themselves up against the face of that dam. The dam was originally a what they call a wood crib dam with cobble. So they built it out of wood and they filled it with cobble. And on the south bank, where the water intake is for the city of Roseburg water, and there's another question that comes up, what would happen if you take the dam out? Where would the city of Roseburg get its water? Well, right there. It just wouldn't be at a dam. It would be in the river as the Umpqua Basin water, several miles downstream gets taken out of an area that's not dammed. So you don't have to have a dam to take water out of the river for drinking water for people. So something like 37,000 people, get their drinking water out of that, from that dam. I would say that actually the water quality would most likely improve because it wouldn't warm up, it wouldn't grow algae, it wouldn't be sort of stagnant, sort of sitting. Well, not exactly stagnant, but it the water quality would be at least as good. But if you look over on that side of the dam, there's a big concrete curve structure, an OG structure, they call it, with kind of an S-shaped curve as the water spills over there. But then the other two thirds of the dam between there and the fish ladder is built on what they call unconsolidated material. It's just cobble at the bottom of the river. And so what's happening is that as that dam has deteriorated over the years, water is coming through cracks in the dam and coming underneath the dam. And so salmon are all their history and selection and all that draws them toward fast water, right? Because they don't want to go where the slow water is because that's likely not to be a channel. They want to find the channel and continue to move upstream. And so they'll head to the bottom of the dam and they'll bash themselves into the rock down at the bottom of the dam, trying to get through there, or they'll try and go in through the cracks with broken concrete and rebar sticking out, which beats them up, scars them up, and in some cases kills them. And also it's a place for predators to, when they're sort of yarded up there, it's more easy pickings for predators. And the same thing, by the way, happens when smolts are out migrating at the top of the dam. before they spill over the top of the dam, they kind of pool up there for a little bit. And then the osprey and herons and various other fish-eating birds will prey on them there. But the ladder there is difficult for them to find, difficult for them to navigate. As a matter of fact, there was just a camera that was put in there at the viewing area. And I was just talking to some friends who had been spending some time watching, and they've seen fish get into that chamber where you can see them and then fall back through and then come back up and fall back through, and, you know, with scars all over them. And so getting fish over that dam is, at best, it delays them. At worst, it kills them.
So I've been watching that as well.
You have, huh?
Yes. Yeah. And I was wondering why they kept swimming forward and then would get pulled back really quickly. And then they'd come up again and get pulled back.
Right. Typically, as a fish migrates through a rapids, there will be various boulders and stuff and rocky sort of underwater outcrops and things that they can sit behind. They're called surge pools. And where the water is swirling around them, but leaves a calm spot behind the rock. And they can get in there and they can rest. And then they can put out a huge amount of power and make it to the next one, and then they can rest. And so if there's no place for them, if it's constant, you know, current all the way, it's more difficult for them to find a place to rest before they push on through to the next spot. So they're sitting in that spot, there's water rushing through it, they're having to, you know, fight that current, they're expending energy before they make it into the next little chamber, you know, up the next step of the ladder and the next step of the ladder. And so there's less surge habitat for them in those ladders. Now, it's an old design, it's a poorly designed ladder. We know a lot more about making fish ladders now. As a matter of fact, the Soda Springs Dam has a state-of-the-art fish ladder in it now that appears to be, you know, working exceptionally well. All along in this whole, you know, conversation, I've been saying we, and I should say more about who we is. Besides Umpqua Watersheds, we're working with a large coalition of folks that are interested in rivers, the Steamboaters Organization, the North Umpqua Foundation, Native Fish Society, Conservation Angler, Trout Unlimited, and a couple of others that don't come to mind right now. But it's a really powerful group of people. And I think one of our biggest strengths is the fact that we are a coalition. I'm probably the only person in the group that doesn't have a fishing license. So they're very much focused on the resource, and they're pretty much all of them avid fishers. And I'm the token upland ecologist that talks about, well, you know, watersheds are big things. They're not just down in the riparian area. And you got to think about what's going on, for example, in those plantations that are pumping more water out of the soil and letting less of it get to the rivers and those sorts of things. So that dam is a fish killer. And even the, you know, the runs of North Umpqua steelhead that I was saying had recovered to relatively healthy numbers, if that dam weren't there, those numbers would grow even more, and all of the other runs would improve, and there'd be even less of a reason to have a hatchery up the North Umpqua if that dam weren't there. So our estimates are that it would cost somewhere around $80 million to fix that dam, to repair the dam so that it doesn't have what we call those false attractions, water coming through the cracks and underneath the dam, and a better way to guide fish into the fish ladder and get them over. I doubt that the Winchester Water Control District, the 100 families that own that dam, are going to spend that kind of money. I mean, there is no way they're going to spend that kind of money. We estimate, Water Watch, I forgot to mention them. They're kind of leading the charge on the dam. They're not so much involved with the hatchery, but Water Watch is really really the lead NGO on the Winchester Dam. And what their proposal is to the Winchester Water Control District is turn the dam over to us. We'll pay to take it out. We'll raise the $10 million or so that it will take to take that dam out and return that to a wild river. Now, there's another argument that where people say, well, what about all the people living along that reservoir? Aren't their property values going to go down? And the answer is no, because they're going to, everybody's going to get an extra, you know, half, three quarters of an acre of land. And instead of being on a water ski boat lake, they're going to be on a world class steelhead river. And so it may not have the same value to them if they like to water ski, right? But it will have the same dollar value or even more to live right backed up to a wild river. So the economic fallout from that will be minimal, except if you have a jet boat and you want to water ski. Those were the people that, you know, whose interest is going to be affected. One other important thing to mention is that if that dam were to fail catastrophically, if the water coming underneath blew out enough gravel to cause that dam to fail, there would be serious damage downriver to property and life. And the folks that own that dam would have a heck of a liability associated with that if that were to fail. And so really getting, you know, taking that dam out, getting rid of that dam would remove a major liability for the folks who own that dam. I don't know how many of those 100 owners have jet boats, but my guess is that it's a minority of them, and that everybody else who owns that dam is sitting there on top of a major liability.
Will the water below the dam significantly rise if it was removed?
Only that initial pulse of water that leaves the reservoir, because the inflow and the outflow are the same. It's just that water gets stacked up there for a while. And there's another interesting issue. The Winchester Water Control District raised $3 million. They passed a tax on themselves that allowed them to raise that money to repair the dam. And unfortunately, the methods that they believe will work to repair the dam, we don't think are going to work. But the interesting part of that is that they believe that they have 300 acre feet. You know, if you took an acre and you piled a foot of water on it, that's a measure of volume of the water. They think they have 300 acre feet, but other estimates believe that it's at least half again that much. And so they were proposing to do their work this summer. But what we did is that we insisted that, as required by law, they do what's called a bathymetric study. They look at the bottom of the lake, they look at the shape of the lake, you know, they hire a consulting company that comes in and does that, and they calculate the exact amount of acre feet in there. And if they have more acre feet in there, so they're going to dewater the lake, right? That part of their idea is that you draw the lake down so that you can get to the dam and work on the dam, and you put up a small coffer dam behind it so that the whole side of the dam is dry so you can work on it. We believe that if there's as much water in that behind that dam as we believe there is, they don't have the water rights to replace that water. So they won't be able to draw the lake down as far as they want it to go, so that they'll have to put in a full coffer dam behind that dam in order to be able to work on it. Or they'll only be able to draw 300 acre feet down. They won't be able to draw the reservoir down as far as they would like to under their current plan. So we're waiting for that. And we're also waiting for an administrative law judge ruling on some other aspects of the dam. Well, so all we're asking them to do is obey the law. And if they can't obey the law, let us take the dam out.
Do you think that with the dam gone, you would be able to use recreational rafting or down it, or would it be too much of an intense situation?
You know what? It doesn't matter how intense it is. There will be people that will kayak it. There are people that kayak, you know, technical rivers like the Klamath and that sort of thing, where, you know, they go beyond class five, right? And so I think the highest class rapids we have on the North Umpqua is, I think it's pinball at class four, and maybe there may be one other up there. So this is the North Umpqua is an awesome river to raft because it's mostly class two and three. It's a fun river. It's not super technical. You don't have to really know what you're doing out there to go out there and have some fun. And going down through there, that just opens up an extra stretch of whitewater river super close to town. And yeah. So I think it would be a really important recreational asset there. And it's a great point that you've brought up, that, you know, beyond, you know, boating and, you know, water skiing and that sort of thing, there'll be plenty of swimming holes. So swimming is, you know, will still be something that you could easily do there. But the other recreational opportunities, the whitewater paddling opportunities and the wild steelhead fishing opportunities there will more than make up for whatever other recreational losses might be incurred.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it would be cool to have an extra strip to go rafting on there.
Yeah, and no doubt there'll be some technical spots in there too, because of where the dam was constructed. So, you know, that, you know, you kind of want to draw it down slowly because there's, you know, hundreds of years of silt behind that dam, that if you dumped it all at once into the, you know, lower stretch. So fortunately, we have a lot of experience in the last several decades taking out dams. We're going to get a lot more experience on the Klamath there with the biggest dam removal in U.S. history project going on down there. So hopefully that the dam removal down there will go really well, and it will give us an example that, you know, you can do this. Technical aspects of it as well as the social aspects of it will be, you know, demonstrated down there on the Klamath in the next few years. I've also heard the concern with Winchester that, as many people know, we have an introduced species in the lower part of the North Umpqua and all up the South Umpqua, the smallmouth bass, that was never part of this system. And they are important predators on these out-migrating smolts. So they, you know, they eat other fish. And certainly when they do stomach content surveys, you know, they'll catch bass and they'll open up their stomach and look what's inside. There's a lot of smolts in there that they eat on their way out to the ocean. And so right now, the big populations of smallmouth bass are all down below the dam. And so some people fear that if you take the dam out, you will open up that stretch of the river to smallmouth bass. Well, the fact is smallmouth bass are already above the dam, but because they are the smallmouth bass are low gradient fish. That is, they like calm, warmer water. And so that's why they thrive in the lower part of the North Umpqua and the main stem and they go pretty far up the South Umpqua because the South Umpqua is a warm, slow river in the summertime. But in the north, there's a concern that, oh, we're going to let all these smallmouth bass up. But the fact is, they're already here. I've seen them. I'm up above the dam, 3 or 4 miles up above the dam. And once or twice, I've seen adult smallmouth bass up here. They don't thrive up here. The water is too fast and too cold, and there are too many other better adapted native fish up in here. I've heard that they've actually caught juveniles all the way up at Steamboat, but they don't thrive. They make it up there, but they don't survive the winters, or, you know, they've never established any populations. So that argument appears to be not a viable argument for not taking out the dam. We should take the dam out, and the smallmouth bass are here. There will be small numbers of them coming up into the North Umpqua, but all the evidence so far suggests that they just won't, they can't tolerate the fast, cold conditions farther up.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I would just, I think I would just say in closing that we have an opportunity here, both at Rock Creek to do nothing there and at Winchester Dam to do something big there, to really improve not only fish runs. I mean, it's pretty, I don't think you could find a fisheries biologist that would say that that taking out that dam would be a bad thing, and that not rebuilding the Rock Creek hatchery would be a bad thing. Again, if there was an emergency situation and you had some environmental catastrophe and you needed to rear, you know, native genetic fish, there's hatchery capacity all over the state that we could use and continue to use the tanks at Rock Creek for acclimation. And certainly taking out the dam would dramatically improve all of the runs of fish that have to get to that hatchery in the first place. So even if you rebuild the hatchery, you're banging them up downstream before they even get there, and you're really disadvantaging them. And so I think we have a great opportunity to make what really is, you know, with all of its challenges, a world-class, you know, fishing river, make it even better. And, you know, all wild fish with pretty much an open run all the way up to the Soda Springs Dam would have lots of opportunity for recreation and all of the economic benefits that having that kind of a resource brings to the area.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be a guest on this episode of Living Downstream. And thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.